Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 2018 session of the Oklahoma Legislature gets underway next week, and it's telling that the legislator's first task will actually be finishing up the work of last year's session. But there is some good news. It's expected for the first time in several years that there will be more revenue for lawmakers to appropriate. And that's tempered by multiple agencies requesting major appropriation increases in order to continue their current level of operations, which at some agencies like education and corrections are at crisis levels. Coupled with several statewide budget and governance reform recommendations like the State Chamber's OK 2030 plan, the Step Up Oklahoma plan, or Together Oklahoma's budgeting reform plans, as well as criminal justice reform advocates working to lower the state's incarceration rate, the session promises to be a challenging one for legislators. My guest today is the Oklahoma Policy Institute's Executive Director, David Blatt. That state think tank issued their 2018 legislative agenda last week at the Legislative Preview Summit, and their priorities include initiatives on budget and taxes, education, criminal justice reform, and health care. David Blatt joins me today on Studio Tulsa. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
You just concluded your organization's Budget and Legislative Preview Summit in Oklahoma City last week. So as we head into the new legislative session here in the coming week, what's your assessment of the mood in Oklahoma City among legislators and the idea about, especially with the what was essentially failed special sessions and the failed session last year to make the budget balance? What's the mood going into Oklahoma City this year?
You know, typically the start of session feels like opening day of the baseball season. This is more like they're going into the 17th inning of a game that just has gone on and on and on.
You got outfielders pitching.
You have outfielders pitching. So we're basically into the 13th month of the 2017 legislative session. They had a four-month session in May, but they used this unconstitutional smoking cessation fee to balance the budget. Supreme Court struck that down in August, so they were called in for a special session in September to try to fill the budget hole for those three health agencies, but also to come up with a comprehensive fix to the budget. They were in for 2 months, came up with a grand bargain that came within five votes of passing. Only in Oklahoma can you get 71 votes out of 97 and still have a measure fail because of our supermajority requirement, which I'm sure we'll say more about. Then they came back for a second special session in December, provided some more supplemental funding for a couple of agencies. But 12 months after the start of the 2017 legislative session, we still haven't completed the 2017 budget, and we still don't have that elusive, comprehensive solution to the state's never-ending budget crisis.
We're running out of time in the 2018 fiscal year. How do you recover that revenue, even if you come up with a fix, in the last 3 to 4 months of a fiscal year?
So right now, what happened when the Supreme Court struck down that smoking cessation fee, although I guess we can call it was really a tax, and that's why
the Supreme Court said it was.
Exactly. So that created a $215 million hole affecting the three large health agencies, the Medicaid agency, DHS, and the Department of Mental Health. Between the two special sessions, two-thirds of that hole has been filled. So there's been about $140 million that's gone to those three agencies, which has allowed them to avert some of those truly catastrophic cuts that we were looking at, and to have enough money that they say they can make it through April. They still need another $70 million between the three agencies to make it through the final 2 months of the year. I think there's good reason to think that whatever happens on these grand bargains or the step-up plan that we'll talk about later on, that there is enough money available to take care of that short-term problem and get those three agencies through June. But we really do have an opportunity and an obligation, really, to try to come up with a broader fix and not just continue to put on another set of Band-Aids and, you know, kick the can down the road.
Now, as we head into this coming fiscal year, as the legislature prepares to budget for it, the estimates look like there's going to be more money, correct?
That's right. So for the first time in about 4 years, we're actually looking at growth revenue, so that tax revenues are going to come in above last year by quite a bit. The problem is that in order to balance last year's budget in both the regular session and in the special session, there was about $500 million of one-time revenue used. Right now, they're projecting growth of about $500 million. So we may be able to cover the hole that was created with the one-time revenue. However, we also know that we're looking at anywhere from $150 to $300 million in obligations on bond payments, on increased employee benefit costs for teachers and support staff. There's maybe a $100 million hole in the Medicaid program because of the feds deciding that we can't use a certain payment plan that we've been using in the past. So we have about $150 to $300 million there. And then, of course, we still need to find the money to give teachers a raise and to give state employees a raise and to deal with our overstuffed prisons and all the other things that have been put off year after year after year.
And you're looking at budget areas where Joe Alsbaugh, the head of corrections, saying, I need $1 billion more.
Absolutely.
So you're seeing every agency coming up and saying, look, we've got to have more money, a lot more money.
Right. So just to look at our correction facilities, our prisons are overstuffed and understaffed. They're at 110% inmate capacity and 70% staffing capacity. So even though we are seeing some significant and hopeful movement on the area of criminal justice reform, that's not happening overnight. And we're either going to have to keep stacking bodies on top of each other or end up on the losing end of a federal lawsuit, or we're going to have to build another facility. With the state health department, which was a complex situation, but we see what happens when we just continue to underfund programs and agencies, you know, year after year after year, you just can't keep everything together. And, you know, a friend of ours, Barry Friedman, says, we've starved the beast and then we claim when the beast is lethargic.
Of course, there's also been some issues with the health department and in its financial accountings. And some conservatives are saying this is a sign of the waste and fraud and abuse that's happening in government. From what you can see, is that a true statement or is it a matter of robbing Peter to pay Paul and moving money around extra constitutionally, if you will?
I don't think we fully know what's happened at the health department, and it is vital that they continue the investigations with the legislature, the state auditors, and now with a grand jury to really get to the bottom of what's happened. But I think that most people who have looked closely at this so far say that this is not corruption. This is not outright fraud that people need to go to jail for. This is really an agency that saw its state appropriations cut year after year after year to the point where they're receiving about 25% less from the state. And they had unfilled vacancies and they had systems that hadn't been upgraded. And they really were moving money around just to try to pay the bills and keep people employed and run the programs. And at a certain point, the money wasn't there and it finally caught up with them, which doesn't mean that people didn't absolutely deserve to lose their jobs. But this is not a major corruption scandal. This is what happens when you just don't fund government adequately over an extended period of time.
Now, before we talk about your legislative agenda, I just want to clarify one point. You mentioned that state revenues are going to be up this year. We do have a bill that was in place that was at least repealed. I'm not sure if it was for 1 year or forever, and that is the income tax lowering when you see increased revenue. Has that been completely repealed, or was it repealed for 1 year only?
No, they actually did repeal that next tax cut. So this was really one of the smartest things they did to avoid a situation where even with this limited revenue growth, which is needed just to make up for the one-time funding, had they not taken that action last session, we would have been looking at another cut to the income tax. And I think what the legislators said is until we can really start meeting our obligations, until we can address some of those critical priorities in terms of funding our teachers in our schools, funding our mental health system and foster care, that moving ahead with another tax cut after already having cut the income tax all the way down from over 6.5% down to 5%, that really is not the right priority. So they did repeal that legislation, which would have, in fact, triggered an automatic tax cut in 2019.
My guest today is David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, as we talk about Oklahoma Policy's 2018 legislative agenda. The legislature opens up next week with the State of the State. first of all, budgets and taxes. This is what we've been talking about for the last few years in all aspects of the legislature. And one of the things you've seen, I think your first priority is the gross production tax. Right. We've seen some efforts to raise that. There's an effort from Step Up Oklahoma, which we'll talk about a little later, that knocks that up to, I think, 4%. Mm-hmm. You say we need to go back to 7%, which is what it's traditionally been through a good portion of the state's
history. Since the 1970s, we have a 7% gross production tax, and we've had a prosperous oil and gas industry through most of that period, and we are very much competitive with other states, even at 7%. But we've allowed this exception rate into our law, which initially was intended to encourage some of that horizontal drilling, some of those deep wells when those were new and experimental. And for a long time, that was a tax break that cost the state a few million dollars a year. But as more and more drilling went horizontal, the cost of that tax break just ballooned to $100 million and then $300 million, ultimately over $500 million a year. Now, they've scaled that back some, but the latest projections are because we're only taxing new production on all wells at 2% for the first 36 months, we're losing about $335 million next year. That will cover our teacher pay raise. That will allow schools to hire more teachers and reduce class sizes. That will deal with some of those waiting lists for critical services for mental health and those with disabilities. So it remains a large, expensive, and unaffordable, unnecessary tax break. So there is a debate about whether to raise the rate to 4% or 5% or 7%. There is an initiative petition effort underway that would raise it to 7% and use the marginal revenue to pay for a teacher pay raise. That may move ahead if the legislature on its own raises it to 4%. That initiative petition effort may lose some steam. But it's encouraging that the voters get this. They understand, everyone appreciates the role of the energy industry in Oklahoma. That isn't up for debate. What's up for debate is, do we need to provide a subsidy to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars for that industry to continue to be active and profitable?
You also say we need to be raising our top marginal rates for income tax. There's been no appetite for that. And of course, as you know, that would require a 75% majority in the legislature to even go anywhere.
It would, but it needs to be part of a balanced revenue plan. So a couple things. One is, if you ask the question of why do we have this chronic budget shortfall, what's responsible for it? The single biggest thing is that we've slashed the top income tax rate, which was 6.65% in the mid-2000s, now it's 5%. That's over $1 billion a year. That is the single biggest contributor. So if we want to get our finances in order, then to calibrate a little bit on the top rate and raise it back up to 5.25%, or have a higher surcharge for income over 200,000 or 400,000, tax that at 6 or 7%. When you think of the big tax cut that people are going to get at the federal level, this is exactly the right time to be doing that. The other thing is, every plan that has been put forward that's supported by the majority of the legislature includes raising the fuel tax and raising the cigarette tax. And those do fall harder on low and moderate income families. And if you're going to ask them to pay more at the pump, then it's certainly reasonable to ask wealthier people who've enjoyed this massive tax cut to pay more, as well as the oil companies to reduce that tax break on oil and gas.
One other area, since we were talking about the fact that any tax rate increase would require a supermajority, is you're talking about a state question 640.
Yes.
Ending that. Now, the Step Up Oklahoma plan talks about moving that down to 60%. Again, this would have to be a vote of the people, because Absolutely. It's in the Constitution. But what are the reasons for even a conservative,
right,
you know, to get rid of this as far as what their future taxes would look like? Because I think probably the popular wisdom is, if we get rid of state question 640, I'm going to get taxed to death.
I think regardless of what the threshold is, it's never going to be easy to raise taxes. That's always going to be a tough call for politicians to make. But I think what we've seen after a quarter century with state question 640, which is the most stringent, restrictive tax requirement in the nation. No other state requires three-quarter vote on any tax increase. And ultimately, it's made Oklahoma ungovernable. It has allowed a small faction of the legislature, one quarter of the members, have a veto over the majority. And we've seen you can always, almost always find 26 members in a 101-member House who are going to say no to any proposal, no matter how reasonable, balanced, how desperate the state's situation is. So I don't think that when Oklahoma voters approve State Question 640, that their intention was to see our teacher salaries fall to lowest in the nation, or our per pupil funding fall to 49th, or to see the prisons operating at 110 capacity. We've seen really serious consequences because the legislators' hands are tied so tightly. So the 60% proposal has been put out there. It resonates because that's what is required at the local level for bond issues. You know, you could certainly make the argument that it should be a simple majority, but 60% seems to be a comfortable compromise that provides some safeguard. Now, some would argue that if we're going to require 60% to raise taxes, we should also be prudent and require 60% to lower taxes as well, so we can maintain that balance. And I think there is a bill to that effect as well. But I think that we are seeing something resembling a consensus around 60%, but it would still require a vote of the people to change the Constitution.
I want to ask about one other budget area before we move to other areas, and that is this probably makes common sense when you first look at it from a traditional voter, and that's the capital gains exemption for Oklahoma businesses. Now, I think at first glance, people would say, well, you know, you're supporting an Oklahoma business. You're supporting something here local, so it's the money staying here. Why is this a bad idea, and why would you say that it's time to end this exemption for capital gains to Oklahoma businesses?
So this is $100 million a year tax break. And when the state brought in a group of experts to study the tax break to see what benefit is it providing, they really couldn't find any. They couldn't find any data that said that this $100 million a year is actually providing the right kind of incentive to get people to invest in Oklahoma companies or Oklahoma property. So we're just basically, it's a pure giveaway to wealthy people because 80% of that tax break goes to households making over $200,000 a year, and a very high percentage just goes to the very wealthiest. So we're just, it's just a straight giveaway. If we're going to use $100 million, you know, we could boost our state earned income tax credit, our sales tax relief credit that goes to seniors and those with disabilities. There's a lot of ways that we could spend that money. We can invest in proven economic development programs and certainly education, where we can say, here's the benefit we're getting. But just to give a tax break because it makes some people feel good, we need to see where's the benefit. And since that can't be shown, let's do away with it.
Yeah. You mentioned education. Obviously, you're in favor of increasing teacher pay. You know, I think it was $1,000 to $2,000 in the last teacher raises in the last legislative session. Step Up Oklahoma has talked about a $5,000. What do you think is the right level at this particular point, given the state's finances?
I think the discussion we had last session on a $1,000 teacher pay raise, which at one point was going to be $500, I think that's a non-starter. I think that we recognize that the situation really is desperate. You look at the number of emergency certifications where a school district cannot find a certified teacher to fill a position. Those used to be rare in Oklahoma. 5 years ago, the State Department issued something like 40 emergency certifications. This year, we're at 1,800. It is so hard to recruit and retain qualified teachers. The exodus of experienced teachers to other states, to other professions, it really is a full-fledged crisis, and I think everybody recognizes it within the education profession, among those with kids and grandkids in the school system. Even our legislators recognize the severity of it. So I think we're seeing the discussion crystallize around a $5,000 raise. Maybe they won't get there in 1 year, but I think they need to do something immediate and urgently because the crisis is real.
You know, we've talked a lot about justice reform, and there have been state questions that have passed. Yep. And yet, as you mentioned earlier, prison populations are bulging, and we're really setting the stage for a federal takeover at some point, which we've had in mm-hmm. Oklahoma's past because of the low number and the poverty line rate wages for guards in the system. and the huge prison population. Why is it taking so long to get these? Is it just a matter of we're not funding these initiatives?
We had a very long period of time where Oklahoma, like much of the nation, just focused on being tough on crime and lock them up. And it's taken a long time to recognize that that approach was not making us safer, and it certainly wasn't making us wealthier. So we are seeing now a convergence of a consensus from the left and from the right, conservatives and liberals, that we need a different approach. I think that criminal justice is the area where we have the greatest optimism about what's going to happen this session. We saw some progress a couple years ago at the legislative level, and then the people who voted solidly to change the sentencing for drug possession to a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony for simple possession charges. Last session, there were some important sentencing reforms that made it all the way through the process and then were blocked simply by the opposition of one committee chair who has subsequently left the legislature to take another job, and that hopefully will unblock things. So there's important sentencing changes. The other area that we're going to be very involved with, which is critical, has to do with fees and fines and the burdens that are placed on people who have been in the criminal justice system, come out and have impossible levels of debt, regardless of their ability to pay. We're working closely with a coalition to come up with different systems to try to debt forgiveness, loan repayments, making sure that those people who leave prison are able to get their lives back on track and don't end up in a situation where they're just, you know, it's hopeless.
I notice bond reform is also a big part of it. You know, if you know anyone who's involved with the criminal justice system, a lot of serious crimes, you sit in the county jail for lengthy amounts of time with high bond,
absolutely,
bonding to get out of jail. And a lot of times it's almost like the system is basically keeping you in jail, waiting for you to basically plea bargain and accepting a guilty plea. And it seems to me that's an area ripe for change, too.
There's lots of potential there as well, where the bond system should be entirely based on the offense that you're accused of, not based on your ability to pay. We're seeing some promising pilot programs here in Tulsa that can be expanded statewide, and we're hopeful that there will be some legislative changes as well to clear up that system so we don't have people languishing in jail for relatively minor offenses simply because $500 or $1,000 is beyond what they're able to pull together.
Or in jail for failure to pay a fine along with a criminal offense.
Yeah. There's tons of that as well.
Last area, healthcare. Once again, you're urging the state to accept federal funds to expand access to health care, and I assume that's expanded Medicaid. Now, in the last presidential administration, we knew there was definite benefits to the bottom line of the state by accepting Medicaid expansion. Is that still the case with the Trump administration?
It is still the case, and we're still seeing some additional states that are looking very closely at Medicaid expansion. We really have grave concerns here, though, about some of the signals that we're getting from the Trump administration on Medicaid. The work requirements, which we're seeing now in Kentucky and in some other states, that are going to create some really difficult obligations on folks. In Oklahoma, most everybody in the working age population that can work does work, but there's still going to be populations because of health issues, caregiver responsibilities, transportation, they're going to school, for whom work is just going to be not feasible. And there really is a risk that with work requirements that we're going to be taking people who need Medicaid coverage to remain in decent health, we're going to kick them off the program. So we hope that there will be careful consideration to expanding Medicaid to cover more of that working age population, but without putting in place onerous, bureaucratic, expensive requirements.
In our last couple of minutes, as you well know, Step Up Oklahoma, it's probably the broadest coalition of business, just about every constituent group in the state has signed on to this nonpartisan group with a fairly complete package to sort of restore state funding. What is your assessment of their proposals, which, you know, you mentioned the cigarette tax, motor fuel increase, gross production tax moving up a couple percent, and changes to the personal income tax. What is your assessment of this plan?
it's really encouraging to see the business community in particular joining into this consensus that Oklahoma has a revenue problem, that we have cut too much, that we've underinvested in those core areas that are critical to our prosperity. So the fact that you had business leaders, civic leaders come together behind a plan, a serious plan, over $700 million in permanent new revenues is highly encouraging. We have some concerns, particularly with the income tax component of the plan, where they have made it, we would say, unnecessarily complicated, where too many folks who are moderate income would end up paying more. And we really hope that they will revisit that. There's also a series of governance reforms, everything from changing the supermajority requirement to how agency directors are appointed, how judges are appointed.
Well, it creates a strong governor system, and traditionally we have a weak governor system.
It does. And I think that the governance part of the package, there's some really promising ideas there. I don't know that they've all been fully vetted, and I think that some of them would benefit from just a good debate to say, how do we want government to operate in Oklahoma and what's the best way to get there? But overall, we're really encouraged by the step-up plan while continuing to encourage them to look again at that income tax component in particular and come up with a better way to get that done.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, when we elect a governor, we really elect the governor based on the idea that this governor is going to be a strong governor. And yet, you know, we're voting for insurance commissioners right. and labor commissioners, in which, let's face it, 90-95% of the population, maybe even more, really don't know. I mean, they're looking at a D and an R, really, frankly.
Right. That's, I think, a valid question. I think there's more concern about changing the superintendent of instruction from an elected to an appointed position. Again, I think that there's some good ideas, and it's positive that those are being put out there, but some of them really do are worthy of a more full debate.
What about the line item budgeting, which this means instead of a big pot of money going to the health department or to education, I assume it means the legislators are going to get into the nitty-gritty of where, you know, each portion of the money goes. Is this a good idea?
The devil's in the details on that. Right. It's going to be what agencies, what programs. The problem is that frequently the legislature in recent years has just given agencies an insufficient amount. And then when they've been forced to make some difficult decisions, you know, they've cut the programs and activities budget for the State Department of Education. And the department has said, okay, we're going to cut funding for early childhood education. And the early childhood advocates have been outraged and said, don't do that. And legislators have come in and said, well, we didn't intend for you to cut that program or this service or so on. So it does seem that if the legislature is going to appropriate the money, they should have some additional accountability for how the money is spent. But the concern is, how much micromanagement do you want from the legislature as opposed to saying to the agencies, you know the programs, you're there day to day, you need to make the decision as to whether that money is better spent on immunizations or on disease prevention.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see what happens this legislative session. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, discussing that institute's legislative agenda for the upcoming session, which begins Monday with a State of the State address by Governor Mary Fallon. Of course, the legislative session also gets underway next week. For more details on the Oklahoma Policy Institute's legislative agenda, visit okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.